Today in Studio 360, a young playwright and actress tackles the very tricky politics of life in Israel.
We are not staying in this crazy place. I'm not willing for him to die while he's doing reserves in Lebanon to protect some stupid settler.
And pulls it off with both seriousness and a lightness of touch.
Can I smoke in here? Is that okay? Fantastic.
Plus, ever wonder exactly how you're going to get through some global disaster?
You make, like, entire cities that are inside.
Setting up colonies on other planets.
Furniture designed by a prison inmate could help.
Cardboard is utilized a lot here.
We put IKEA out of business.
You're the weak.
And later on, Samuel Jackson never sounded so...
Tu es faible.
French?
Et que je suis la tyrannie des méchants.
But I'm trying, Ringo.
Et moi, j'essaie, Ringo.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI's Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We hear about Israel in the news pretty much every day, but how many of us have any sense of what the life of a typical Israeli is like? And for that matter, what a typical person in Israel is? Would you imagine that it could be an ecstasy-addled hippie girl or an evangelical Christian or a gay German or a Palestinian professor? In her riveting one-woman play, Di, that means enough in Hebrew, Iris Bar is every one of those people, as well as seven more. It takes place during one afternoon in a cafe in Tel Aviv. Iris was born in New York City but lived in Israel as a teenager and served in the Israeli army before returning to the U.S. She's now in her early 30s, but she's also just come out with a funny, raunchy memoir called Dork Whore about traveling in Asia as a very young woman. Iris, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Best title ever, by the way.
Thank you.
I would love it if you could start us off with a bit of your play, Di, to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about. Character of your choice.
Hi, Kurt. My name is Uzi, and I am from Kibbutz Le'avot HaBashan. Do you know Kibbutz Le'avot HaBashan? Of course not. We're at the end of the world. It's so funny. A few weeks ago, a producer is calling me from Los Angeles. You know Los Angeles, yes? I remember the kibbutz as a young boy. We used to call him Panas, flashlight, because he was so white, we could see him coming out of the chicken coop in the middle of the night from a kilometer away. He's so excited. He's saying, wow, soldiers getting kidnapped, the war in Lebanon. I can't believe you haven't made a movie about it yet. I said, you Americans are so funny. You have one war in Vietnam, you're making 500 movies about it. A prime minister gets assassinated, you're already thinking which actor will play him before he's even buried in the ground.
Now, Iris, Uzi, of all the characters in this play, is what I would think of as, oh, that's what Israelis are like, that guy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. I think he represents the Zionists of old, in a way. Someone who really fought for the country and for its existence and still has that feeling. It's very strong in his body. And his story, actually, you know, one of his older son was injured and is now in a coma, and his younger son wants to run away to New York instead of getting drafted, and that obviously is devastating.
To clean carpets.
To clean carpets.
To clean carpets.
Yes.
And unlike that guy, Uzi, who is a kind of archetypal old-school Israeli, there is a character who I guess is a settler in the West Bank who, at least when I saw the play, she was the character who seemed to make the audience most palpably nervous to watch.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's Shuli, and she's actually American, and she moved, you know, I can't stop. They just take me over. Good God. Moved to Israel. She's a settler in the West Bank, and truly believes that the Jewish nation has existed for thousands of years before Islam was even born. And you know, she the arguments, which are all very prevalent among that community, you know. Ask any archaeologist to show you Palestinian artifacts, and he won't have any to show you. Ask him to show you Jewish artifacts, he will beam with pride from the wealth of his collection, you know. And it's a balance in that crowd. Some people are nervous, some people are like, oh, this message is out, you know, and people need to hear this more. It's very interesting.
Well, and you let no one off the hook, which is one of the beauties of this piece. Everybody ought to be squirming a little bit sometime.
Yeah, I would hope, yes. I try and, show how Israeli society is conflicted and there are no answers, and to humanize. I think that everybody's opinions come from a very personal place. And, you know, you have Alma, who's the Israeli expat, who I live in Long Island, and I have two children, a boy and a girl, Cassidy and Dylan. If you have photo, I can see you. You want to see photos? They're very cute, right? And it's like third world over there. And I told Moti, we are not staying in this crazy place. I'm not willing for him to die while he's doing reserves in Lebanon or to protect some stupid settler. People like Yossi, they think it's okay to live in the middle of Palestinian land. It's their land. Let them live, poor souls. There are a million places to live. You have to live right there. It's unbelievable. Can I smoke in here? Is that okay? Fantastic.
I love that character. But what's interesting, and I guess I'm going to have to give one of your premises away, is that for all of its comedy, each of these monologues is interrupted by a suicide bomber's bomb going off.
Yes.
Which causes real anxiety, at least for me. And even though, okay, I know now I know this is coming, you can't get used to it,
right?
You know, and you then listen to everybody's monologue, even as you're laughing, with this horrible sense that they're goners. At what point in conceiving this work did you come up with that idea?
I think very early on, I had wanted to create a visceral experience in the audience of what it's like to sit in, you know, be in an environment where there is constant tension. I have to say that, you know, most Israelis sit in cafes and have managed to transcend that, or, you know, at least kind of suppress it. But I want to take advantage of it being a theatrical experience and kind of jar them, and also to desensitize in a way. I think it's a combination.
Visceral is right. It's really loud, for one thing.
Yeah, it is really loud, yes.
Would you ever think about moving back to Israel?
Yes, yes. I think about it all the time. I think it's kind of a joke where you meet a lot of Israelis going, oh, yeah, you know, we're moving back in a year, and then that's 50 years later, they're still living in Long Island. But I'd like to. I think it's hard. As an artist, I think that I want to take advantage and possibly bring this show to Israel and perform it there. It may be a little more sensitive there than, you know, but I don't know. I think that people are hungry for that catharsis in a way.
How do you think it will play there?
There have been a lot of Israelis that have come to see the show here. And I think it's been a while since there has been, thank God, you know, a big spate of suicide bombing. So I think that people are be able to experience it. And they enjoy the humor. I mean, that's the irony of, you know, people laugh. I mean, they laugh a second before I die, you know? So I think that they're really with the characters. And I think it's not about preaching or, you know, hitting people over the head and, oh, look at me writhing on the floor. It's not that. And I tried not to do that.
For the Palestinian, this wonderful Palestinian professor character, this woman, what kind of research or work did you do to sort of figure out her?
I think I created her from inside, I have to be honest. I think that I wanted to bring forth an idea of a woman, a Palestinian intellectual who is conflicted also. I think that's the whole idea I have of, you know, not an extremist or not bring the suicide bomber, to bring the mother of the suicide bomber and how she's trying to, you know, make her son's life less bleak, like she said, so he's not willing to give it up. And so
it is tiring, our life. The few hours I can sit here and have coffee before rushing back for curfew are like a dream. Here I can sit and pretend my life does not exist. I close my eyes and hear the clanking of the espresso machine, smell the freshly baked pastries. I could be anywhere, Paris or Prague. The conversations around me are about children, money, technology, postdoc programs at Columbia, startup companies at Herzliya. Did you know that Israel has more biotech companies than anywhere in the world outside Silicon Valley? Yusuf hates when I tell him that. My son, yes. I tell him that cell phone you're talking on, Yusuf, was actually developed in Motorola Israel. He says I'm spitting on my own people with these stupid statistics. We are not lucky enough to be the paid puppets of America. I understand where he is coming from. How can we attain such accomplishments when we are occupied, bombed, harassed, tortured, unable to feed our own children, let alone start a startup? Yes, Yusuf, occupation has bled us dry, but what are we doing to remedy? Look who we put in power. Yes, they have built us a few clinics, but they have no value for this life. Why would they try to better it?
Like, I wanted the Israelis that may have certain opinions to look at this woman and understand her and respect her and therefore listen more. Just as, like, I had a Muslim woman come up to me when I first did the show on Bleecker, and she said to me, thank you for changing my perspective, which was great because she didn't say it changed opinion or anything like that. It was just something that was like, oh, wow, just giving a little window into something going, oh, okay, I didn't look at it that way. Great. That's all you can really ask for besides obviously entertaining and moving people, which is my main goal.
As a kid, did you grow up making, you know, imitating everybody in your family and your friends?
I used to pretend to speak Spanish very fast. That was a big fun one for the guests. Iris, do your little Latin chick, you know. That was, yeah. I've always liked morphing into different characters. I did another one-woman show called Planet America that I did 5 years ago in L.A. about various immigrants in New York and their experience. This was before Bridge and Tunnel.
I was going to say, you were the Sarah Jones of L.A. before Sarah
Jones.
Yeah,
I didn't know about it. I remember doing the show in L.A. and then I remember hearing an interview or something about Sarah Jones. But I remember like, what? Oh, hi. But, you know, that's my experience. I mean, my parents are both Bulgarian-Israeli that moved to New York. My mom's side is Spanish originally. And so I've definitely been a mutt and grown up in a very, well, Israel in general is a very, you know, we're all immigrants.
The play is funny, but as we've discussed, at its core has this hard political resonance. Your book, Dork Whore, it's called, it seems more purely playful and entertaining.
Yes, it is indeed. It's possibly the farthest thing from die. You know, you have all these people in their 70s and 80s coming to the show, and then they look at the postcards for Dork Whore and they can't wait to buy it. I'm like, please, you don't want to, you know, you'll be horrified. This is not the me that you want to remember. Yeah, it's very sexually graphic and funny and light, and it is personal. I mean, I'm kind of an open wound in general. I think I always put my heart and soul out on the table, even in the show and in the book too. But it definitely was fun to write, and it's a fun read. It's not.
Why did you want to do it?
You know, I had traveled around Asia for, you know, 6 months after the army. A lot of Israelis do that, kind of backpack, and I traveled alone. And I did have some issues like my pseudo-virginity that I was trying to contend with. And that was one of my goals on the trip, as you know, realize in the book. And
having gotten that version of you down on paper at 30, do you look back and go, jeez, what a young and crazy girl I was?
No, I'm still a mess. So I think it manifests itself in other ways.
You're just an older mess?
I enjoy that journey. I enjoy that part of me. I thrive on that insecurity in a way. I think that, yes, I'm much less insecure than I used to be, and
good.
I'm no longer a virgin.
Good.
In many, many ways. So I'm happy to be able to share that and hopefully guide other young women who want to whore themselves out and do it properly.
In foreign countries.
Yeah, exactly.
Iris Barr, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Iris Barr's memoir, Dork Whore, is out right now. And you can hear Iris perform more characters from her play, Die, on our website, studio360.org. In a minute, we'll try to come to grips with the end of the world.
People used to talk about the beginning of the world, and it seems like everyone's talking about the end of the world now.
That's in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I turn an atheist to a God-fearing believer. Stay with us. Your body's found by children. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. So, when do you think the world will end? Sooner rather than later, according to the people we asked on the street the other day.
I think the world will end when it's ready to, which is probably pretty soon.
2012? There's a lot of signs that point to that. Mayan calendar, Buddhist calendars, Hopi Indian calendars.
2099. That's the end of the world.
I'm hoping when the sun explodes it'll end and not sooner.
I think it will start on our moon, or maybe even Mars.
There has to be an end. There was a beginning. Yeah, isn't that the way things always work?
Predicting that everything is about to go kablooey is nothing new. Remember Y2K? We got a pass on that one. But a lot of fundamentalist Christians are eagerly anticipating the end times. So eagerly, there's even a video game now in which you try to save souls before it's all over.
And as the prophets foretold, God will come to take his people home. No one knows the day or the hour.
And that, I swear, is the real thing, not a parody. But the extinction of civilization or of life itself is no longer just the province of religion or science fiction. We were reminded of it on Oscar night.
And the Oscar goes to An Inconvenient Truth.
Our ability to live is what is at stake.
Probably the most extraordinary novel I read last year is set in a post-apocalyptic world right around the corner. It's called The Road, and it's by one of America's finest novelists, Cormac McCarthy. Rob Spillman, a critic and editor, walks us through the novel.
The premise is very simple. It's a father and a young boy, perhaps 8 years old. They're walking down a road where the entire landscape has been blasted and charred, and they are looking for food and shelter, trying to avoid cannibals, because that is what a lot of the refugees have been reduced to. The young boy travels with his little yellow toy truck. You know, they're homeless refugees. They're pushing a shopping cart with all their belongings in it. And they have, you know, taped cardboard to their feet for shoes, and they're in rags. And they very much look like poor pilgrims on the road to hopefully salvation.
They passed through towns that warned people away with messages scrawled on the billboards. The billboards had been whited out with thin coats of paint in order to write on them, and through the paint could be seen a pale palimpsest of advertisements for goods which no longer existed. They sat by the side of the road and ate the last of the rotten apples. What's on your mind?
Nothing.
We'll find something to eat. We always do. That's not it, is it?
It's okay.
Tell me. I want you to tell me. It's okay.
It's nothing, Papa.
Look at me. Are you crying? Just tell me.
We would never eat anybody, would we?
No, of course not.
Even if we were starving?
We're starving now.
You said we weren't.
I said we weren't dying. I didn't say we weren't starving.
But we wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't.
No matter what?
No. No matter what.
Because we're the good guys.
Yes.
And we're carrying the fire.
And we're carrying the fire. Yes.
Okay.
You know, McCarthy being an older man, facing his own mortality, is probably not going to be around when his own son becomes an adult. He's fairly recently remarried and has a young son, and the book is dedicated to this son. I imagine this is, his sort of love letter to his son and his hope for his own son, even in the bleakest of circumstances, which is death, that it's somewhat of a pilgrimage, and that the boy is the chosen one to survive and perpetuate the species.
They walked through the streets wrapped in filthy blankets. He held the pistol at his waist and held the boy by the hand. At the farther edge of the town, they came upon a solitary house in a field, and they crossed and entered and walked through the rooms. They came upon themselves in a mirror, and he almost raised the pistol. "It's us, Papa," the boy whispered. "It's us."
What they are heading for is the ocean, and the father cannot tell his son whether the ocean is still blue or not. When they finally do reach the ocean, the boy asks, "Do you think there's anybody out there?" And McCarthy has reduced it to a very, very simple level where they might literally be the last two people like themselves on the planet.
They sat with their heels dug into the sand and watched the black sea wash up at their feet, cold, desolate, birdless. He had left the cart in the bracken beyond the dunes, and they had taken the blankets with them and sat wrapped in them in the wind shade of a great driftwood log. They sat there for a long time. Along the shore of the cove, below them, windrows of small bones in the rack. Farther down, the salt bleach rib cages of what might have been cattle. Gray salt rime on the rocks. The wind blew, and dry seed pods scampered down the sands and stopped, and then went on again.
Do you think there could be ships out there?
I don't think so.
They wouldn't be able to see very far.
No, they wouldn't.
What's on the other side?
Nothing.
There must be something.
Maybe there's a father with his little boy, and they're sitting on the beach.
That would be okay.
Yes.
And they could be carrying the fire, too.
They could be.
But we don't know. So we have to be vigilant.
We have to be vigilant. Yes.
How long can we stay here?
I don't know. We don't have much to eat.
I know.
You like it?
Yeah. Can I go swimming?
Swimming?
Yes.
Your freezer took us off.
I know.
It will be really cold. Worse than you think.
That's okay.
I don't want to have to come in after you.
You don't think I should go?
You can go.
But you don't think I should?
No. I think you should.
Really?
Yes. Really.
Okay.
He rose and let the blanket fall to the sand, and then stripped out of his coat and out of his shoes and clothes. He stood naked, clutching himself and dancing. Then he went running down the beach, so white. Knobby spine bones, the razorous shoulder blades sawing under the pale skin, running naked and leaping and screaming into the slow roll of the surf.
I don't know if I like this book. I was totally horrified by this book. I would not wish this book on anyone. But I also, once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. I was so swept up in this world. And I felt like I had to keep reading the book to keep the characters alive. And I thought he created such a complete world that it was almost suffocating. You could not get out of this world, and only this world could exist while you were reading it. And I think that's what you ask of a great book, is to be totally convinced that you're in a different world.
Rob Spillman edits the literary magazine Tin House. Larry Pine read the part of the father and narrator in Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and Charlie Panic was the boy. Pike Malinowski produced our story. Daniel Pinchbeck is a journalist who's gotten a lot of attention for his own account of the coming apocalypse. It involves crop circles and visitation by deities. And Pinchbeck is completely serious. The book is called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. It takes as its starting point ancient Mayan predictions, as translated by modern archaeologists, that life as we know it will change radically, totally, just 5 years from now. In fact, Daniel Pinchbeck thinks that process is already well underway.
You know, we're actually in this apocalypse period right now. It's not that it's coming. and all around the world, like we're very sheltered in our lives here. But, you know, whether it's Iraq or large parts of Africa, a lot of people are already being subjected to a kind of miserable state of existence. And what we have right now is a small window to catalyze a shift in human consciousness, or we will end up in a Cormac McCarthy scenario, and we probably won't survive as a species past this century.
Pinchbeck was high when he became convinced that the Maya were onto something. He was making a sort of vision quest that had brought him to the Brazilian Amazon, way south of the Mayan territory, to a native religious community called the Daime. They gave him a hallucinogenic brew called ayahuasca. And at first, it was not a good trip.
I've been having a hard time with Daime on that trip. I mean, it's very much a religion. Everybody wears white. The men and women are separate. It's Christian. So all of my sort of cynical antipathy towards religion had been coming up. And then I'd also been thinking very skeptically about, you know, the Mayan calendar and, oh, there's just like no hope and we're just in a disaster. And, you know, where's this Quetzalcoatl, you know, when he's supposed to show up and it's just getting worse and worse. And then this voice in my head said, you know, here I am, and began to dictate this prophetic, you know, transmission.
Does the college-educated empirical skeptic in you that's obviously...
Dropout, actually. College dropout.
Still. You're a journalist. You were a skeptic. Yeah. Did you ever say to yourself, well, maybe I'm just going nuts?
Sure. Say it all the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, but then also if you look at our society has gone nuts. You know, we've got the climate change, which is accelerating, could cause large-scale famine. You know, we have the polar ice caps melting. We have human sperm count declining 1% per year. You know, we've put this a huge assault on our own planet.
If we've only got 5 years, give or take, to change our global consciousness to deal with this tumult, how can we possibly do it?
I think we have less time than that, actually. I think we probably have about 2 or 3 years. There's no doubt that we're going to go through a transformative process. And the question is, what is that process going to be like? And my hope would be that it would be a totally peaceful shift into a compassionate global culture. And I don't think that's out of the question at all. I mean, I think when we saw something like the Berlin Wall, nobody, you know, was predicting that something like that could happen. You know, but if there is going to be something like that Berlin Wall moment, we're going to need different sort of maps and paradigms and alternative structures. And for some people, it might be, you know, biodiesel, investing in alternative energy. You know, for somebody else, it might be bringing a little more illumination into a corporate boardroom or yoga practice. But I do feel there's this wave effect happening right now, just as in the early 60s. I think what triggered the early 60s was the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, and it was this awareness that we were that close to ending the whole situation that clicked people open to all sorts of other possibilities.
I used to do yoga, so maybe I'm good. Shifting your consciousness in the correct fashion doesn't necessarily entail psychedelic drugs. Pinchbeck gives the example of technology. It can isolate us from each other or connect us.
Cell phones and social networks, these things are actually beginning to have an effect on the nature of the self and the psyche. Rather than that sort of isolated, hard, kind of alienated self of the 19th and 20th century modernist period, you have now a more kind of permeable or relational self. And for me, I see that as positive.
There are various books and movies out right now that deal with apocalyptic themes in some fashion. Have you seen, for instance, Children of Men?
Yeah, I did see Children of Men. And for me, it's very much like this Cormac McCarthy thing. And it's like, for me, we're trapped right now because we're caught in this individuation process. And so all we're seeing is the dark side.
What is the individuation process?
Well, I mean, that's this Jungian concept. It's like, you know, when you're totally identified with, you know, the ego. I mean, our whole culture is based around fulfilling the insatiable desires of the ego, you know, through materialism, through stuff, you know, and because we don't have any, you know, more transcendent or kind of wiser belief in other levels of consciousness, we fear death as the absolute ending of whatever we're doing. So we're like trapped in this frequency. And to me, these cultural artifacts are kind of manifestations of that trap.
So when you see the version of the hellish end of the world in a movie like Children of Men, that's not the way to think about it? There's a third path?
Yeah, I mean, it may be that we need them as cautionary tales, but I also feel there's a way that our cultural artifacts kind of work to numb us in a way, you know, to deaden our receptors to what's actually going on. And we really need to become very, very, very attentive to the reality that we're in and other options and pathways that we've missed because our culture has been so forceful in terms of legitimating only certain possibilities. So we have to identify that the aspects of that predatory energy inside of ourselves and then create our own antidote.
Daniel Pinchbeck doesn't really have many practical tips for handling his version of the coming apocalypse. But let's assume the inconvenient truth is true, that there will be famines and floods and food shortages. We're all going to be affected. Where, in that case, are we going to put our stuff? I'm not being facetious. Peter Crimmins talked with an artist who's designing for the worst-case scenario.
In 2004, Peggy Diggs had a gig as an artist-in-residence in downtown Manhattan. She was two blocks from the site of the World Trade Center, so disaster was on her mind.
I read this article from the London Observer, which says that a secret report, I'm reading this, a secret report suppressed by U.S. defense chiefs and obtained by the Observer warns that major European cities will be sunk beneath rising seas as Britain is plunged into a Siberian climate by 2020. And it goes on, and I thought, okay, well then, we're in trouble.
Yesterday, some 23,000 refugees left the New Orleans Superdome by bus, headed for the Houston Astrodome, where they're
starting to arrive. Like we all saw in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, people caught up in the swath of disaster wind up living like refugees. Peggy Diggs thought that when the big one hits, you're going to need furniture, something easy to build, compact, something lightweight, because you might be living on a cot in a barracks or a bunker or a sports arena. You might feel like a prisoner the way you're living, and you're going to need a place to put documents, your photos, your clean socks. You're going to need something to lift you up off the floor. Peggy Diggs was inspired by a museum show she saw once about household objects designed by prisoners to alleviate the squalor of their cells. And a light bulb went off.
I could use prisoners to contribute to the culture at large what they already know. They know how to be restricted, how to be inventive within a restricted environment.
Diggs knew nothing about industrial arts, but she mentioned the idea to a friend of hers in Philadelphia who runs an arts program inside Graterford, a maximum security prison in Pennsylvania. It's called a mural arts program, and it hires inmates to paint murals for the city.
These are guys who've done bad things, and we tend to shut them up and keep them unutilized. Everybody's an expert at something, and when the time comes, anybody's expertise could be absolutely crucial.
I want it to be something I would use, something I could see myself sort of putting together in my cell. Some of the guys in here, they make shelves in their cells out of cardboard. And, you know, you walk into their cell and you'll be like, damn, that's a slick little idea that he got there.
That is Eddie. In Graterford and in prisons generally, cardboard is gold. Cardboard is one of the few things you're allowed to have in your cell. This is Day Day. He's another prisoner at Graterford.
I got this cabinet that I actually use as a desk. I flip the door open and it lays right on my lap and I sketch with that. My partner, Tone, he had this box where he had a TV sitting in there with all these drawers coming out the sides and stuff, and it was pretty huge.
Cardboard is utilized a lot here.
Yeah, I was thinking about we would put IKEA out of business.
Might be hearing this right now.
That is Zafir and Spell. With Day-Day and Eddie and a handful of other guys, they created a desk design to be made from heavy cardboard. The desk is about 3 feet high. And on first approach, it looks like a chest of drawers. It has 8 cubby holes underneath the top surface. But the cubbies are hinged. They pivot outward to allow space for your knees. So each desk is hand-painted by the prisoners in his own expressive style, often drawing from tattoo designs and graffiti.
What I like so much about it is that it's industrial design meets folk art in the prison. And it's just a goofy, wonderful mix of elements that had to come together out of necessity.
Peggy Diggs brought the design to an industrial manufacturer who cut cardboard for about 20 desks. Those cutouts were then assembled and donated to a public elderly care facility in Philadelphia called Riverview. Ernestine Stevens is a resident there who got one of the desks in her room. It's a white desk, and it's covered in roughly painted oblong circles of lavender, which look a bit like faces.
That's gorgeous. It's a warmness. It represents how they feel on the inside spiritually.
Not much is known about Ernestine Stevens, other than her name. She was homeless before she came to Riverview, and she's not talking about where she came from. The staff at Riverview really know nothing about her past.
If I had my life to live over again, I don't think I would be here. Matter of fact, I know I wouldn't. I'm just like they are. I took the wrong turn. I like what they're doing because they're putting a light on other people's lives, a cheerful light, and that means a lot. Well, like it did me. It put a cheerful light on me.
From the get-go, Peggy Diggs always wanted the desks to be made available to the world at large, to the Red Cross, to victims of environmental disaster, victims of war. This is Peggy Diggs' new headache.
It seems after all of this work, the project runs the risk of falling into that black hole of hard work. They all work so hard. There it goes. The end.
At issue here are the prisoners, or rather, the prison system. Prisoners cannot hold patents for any work they've done on the inside. And without a patent, there can't be any mass production. So for months, she and her lawyer have been trying to figure out what they can do with these desks. The prisoners, for their part, just want to keep on designing and making art. Well, really, they want to get out. But a lot of these guys are in for life. They're never getting out. So second best, contribute whatever they can to the community at large from the inside.
We're not looking for any accolades or anything. We sparked it. Mm-hmm. And the spark is just igniting and continues to reignite.
It's been established that what we have done is rewarding. Yeah, I mean, so you can keep playing it forward.
For Studio 360, I'm Peter Crimmins.
And you can see some of the furniture designed by Peggy Diggs and the mural arts artists of Greaterford Prison at studio360.org. Coming up, Samuel L. Jackson, en français.
Everybody knows the story. I mean, there are snakes in the plane.
Tu sais qu'on avait imaginé tous les scénarios possibles.
Hey, somebody has to dub the movies.
Je suis face à un auquel on n'avait pas pensé.
That's next in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. Studio 360, I'm Kurt Anderson. One of the legendary towns in American music is Kansas City. By the 1920s, KC boomed with great blues and ragtime and swing. The musicians had a union, Local 627, and the Union Hall is where the distinctive sound of Kansas City jazz came together. Its late-night jams brought players from around the world. The hall is still there. It's now known as the Mutual Musicians Foundation. But a recent crackdown by liquor authorities in Kansas City has left jazz fans wondering if Kansas City jazz can live on as the real thing in the 21st century. KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross visited the foundation late one recent Saturday night. Actually, it was early one recent Sunday morning.
It's a little stucco-covered building. Probably the only National Historic Landmark open from 1 to 5 a.m. on weekends. Inside a wood-paneled lounge, a trio plays for a half dozen guys. There's coffee brewing behind the bar, but word has it that some people are carrying flasks.
Hey, Betty. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Betty Crow is a board member of the Mutual Musicians Foundation, but in recent years, she's become a kind of den mother.
It's late night. You're relaxing. The guys have come off their gigs, you know, and they just want to relax, play a little more, have a drink, you know, cool. Get down, you know.
Last fall, Kansas City police were tipped off to the parties, and a couple of cops stopped by to tell them they had to pack up the beer. The hall had been operating without a liquor license since, well, Prohibition. So the authorities let them continue the jam sessions without alcohol. But Crow says attendance has dwindled.
Usually about 3 o'clock, you can hardly walk through, you know. But it'll pick up.
The foundation's walls are tiled with black and white photos of former union members, like the legendary Count Basie, pianist Mary Lou Williams, and saxophonist Lester Young, and band leaders who came through, like Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway. Black musicians founded the union in 1917 to protect themselves from exploitation by white club owners. In 1930, Local 627 moved into this building in the heart of Black Kansas City. Jazz historian Chuck Haddock says this song, Pete Johnson's 627 Stomp, was written to evoke the late-night jams at the Union Hall.
This is a good example of the pure Kansas City style, the walking bass line, the use of contrasting riffs, the solos, and just the beat.
Singer Myra Taylor began performing in the 1930s at the age of 14. She says the Union was also a practice hall. One time, a club owner told Taylor's band they were playing too loud for his customers to hear each other.
So he told the band to play softer. Then the musician said, well, you can't swing when you play softly, you know. So the man said, you either get it soft or you're fired. So they would come here and rehearse and do whatever had to be done. And you go back, you like that man wants you to be because you want your job, his best job in town, see.
If the Union hadn't existed,
it wouldn't happen.
When trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie first met saxophonist Charlie Parker, who was playing with bandleader Jay McShann at the time, they all went over to Local 627 to jam.
Yeah, you might say bebop was born right upstairs at the foundation.
And Haddock says the whole jazz scene was well lubricated by alcohol.
I'm sure that Basie had a little taste when he was playing. Bird was a member of the Union. Lester Young, I'm sure that there were more than a few bottles in those music cases. So this has been going on for a long, long time.
But in the late 1930s, the governor of Missouri cracked down on immoral behavior, and many jazz clubs were shut down. Local 627 was just a Union hall, so the jams continued there. And they're still going today.
It's $8 donation.
I know, right?
Per person.
Bray Reed is the doorman at the foundation. Three young people show up. They've been partying already, but they didn't know the foundation had gone dry.
Are you serious?
No liquor.
There's no liquor
here.
No, you didn't know that?
I thought you knew it.
Before the raid, some people were coming just because it was the only spot to drink after the other bars in town closed at 3 a.m.
They usually drink, go get some more drinks, and pass out. We had to pick them up off the floor, kept poor Betty going to get ice and going to get towels and talking about taking a CPR class.
Yeah.
I mean, they just kept poor Betty busy.
Betty Crow says the problems were typical of any bar. And now some musicians and patrons actually appreciate the alcohol and smoke-free vibe. Singer Erica Brazil says that for her, drinks aren't important.
I come here because I just, you know, the familiar faces I see. Get up, sing a few tunes, feel the spirit with them. You know, go home tomorrow morning and wake up at noon.
The reality is, without liquor, attendance has been so low that the Mutual Musicians Foundation can't pay the utilities and maintenance for the building. They might consider more conventional hours, but it's the late-night jam sessions that make the foundation unique.
These guys, they left their music here. The music is in the building. It is a live museum.
The foundation's board recently applied for a tavern license, and that means they'll open a little earlier sometimes, and last call will be at 3 a.m. But Crow says the musicians are determined to keep jamming till dawn.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again.
For Studio 360, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Last call for alcohol, get going.
If you'd like to see what the Mutual Musicians Foundation looks like, you can have a look at studio360.org.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The minutes fly by. 8, 9, 10. That old clock's ticking. About time to say goodnight. This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up. Then order again.
Jazz has always been one of the great, distinctly American exports. Hollywood movies, though, don't seem quite as American once they go abroad.
Skywalker,
de croire qu'il est protégé par la force.
Dubbing is a well-oiled machine in most big foreign markets, with name actors doing the dialogue. In France, for instance, Daniel Beretta has been the voice of Arnold Schwarzenegger since 1987. And both Mel Gibson and Homer Simpson are played by somebody called Hubert Gagon. And this is the voice of Samuel L. Jackson in the new movie Black Snake Moans.
Suis-moi, plus vite que ça! T'as une femme blanche à moitié nue que tu gardes au bout d'une chaîne.
Je sais très bien ce que je fais. Alors viens pas me bourrer le mou.
Je te dis que ça va, alors ça, tu l'enlèves.
Non.
So, who is this guy?
My name is Thierry Desrose. I'm a French actor and I do the voice of Samuel L. Jackson.
You know what they call a quarter pound of a cheese in France?
My voice is nearly the same, not the same really, because we've got many different accent and intonation, and but it's very close.
Mm-hmm. Ça, c'est un excellent hamburger.
I never did dubbing before. I was in theater, and a woman came and she saw the play, and she called me and said, can you come to make a casting for a movie? And nobody knew this movie would be a very big movie. It was Pulp Fiction.
You read the Bible, Ringo?
The big scene when he said, do you read the Bible?
Ezekiel 25:17.
It was so hard to do.
The path of the righteous man is beset on
not just saying the words, but to be with him and to be like him, you know?
Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill...
Béni soit-il l'homme de bonne volonté qui, au nom de la charité, se fait le berger des faibles qu'il guide dans la vallée d'ombre de la mort et des larmes, car il est le gardien et la providence des enfants qui se sont égarés. Everybody remember this scene. I met a lot of young actors who took this scene for an audition because it's, for us in France, it's a very, very strong scene.
The truth is, you're the weak. And I am the tyranny of evil men.
Ce qui est vrai, c'est que tu es le faible et que je suis la tyrannie des méchants.
But I'm trying, Ringo.
Mais moi, j'essaie, Ringo.
I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
Au prix d'un effort harassant de protéger les faibles. Since Pulp Fiction, I did 28 movies with him.
My name is Blade.
I do the voice of Wesley Snipes.
Je m'appelle Blade. Je suis né mi-humain, mi-vampire.
I did Lawrence Fishburne. We were two actors. We do Lawrence Fishburne. And I'm the French voice of Eric Lassalle, the doctor in UR. E-R-E-R-E-R. Because it's called Urgence in French. They are all black. It's just because people have no time to... you know, to think or find the real voice. And it's not right, because I know many white guys who dub black actors, and I dub sometimes white actors. But it's easier. And for me, it's okay, because I have work. To dub a movie, you've got the screen, and under you've got a white band, which is written the text on it, and you have to watch what the actor does. And you try to understand what does the actor gave in the scene, and then you play.
Pour trouver le chasseur, il faut dénicher sa proie.
You want to catch the hunter, you start with the prey.
If you don't play the same, if you just make the voice, if you don't try to feel like he felt when he did the movie, you are not in the screen, so it doesn't work. The most important is to watch the eyes, because if the feeling is okay with the original acting, you see it in the eyes.
You know all those security scenarios we ran? Well, I'm smack in the middle of one we didn't think of.
The last movie that I dubbed, it was Snake on a Plane. Everybody knows the story. I mean, there are snakes in the plane. And there's a big catastrophe, and Samuel L. Jackson is the hero, so everything goes okay at the end.
Tu sais qu'on avait imaginé tous les scénarios possibles, mais je suis face à un auquel on n'avait pas pensé.
I'm in the service of the actor and the movie, and even if I don't like it, I have to do it, because he did it. Sometimes I can ask to myself, why he did this movie? Why? to dub, you have to be in the service of the original. For me, it's a school of humility, because that's not you who plays the part.
I think we should be leaving now.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
You have to forget yourself and go in the movie.
Je crois qu'on devrait peut-être y aller, là.
Oui, c'est pas une mauvaise idée.
The actor Terry DeRose. You can hear him in the French version of the new movie Black Snake Moan, along with Marie Eugenie Maréchal, voicing the Christina Ricci role. Studio 360 is not yet available in French, but we are available by podcast, and you can find out what's coming up on the show with our weekly newsletter, written entirely in English. To subscribe, just go to studio360.org. Thank you very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll tune in next week and listen again. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Brendan Baker,
Brooke Schumann,
Hadara Grobart.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Growing up in India, filmmaker Meera Nair didn't see a lot of movies, but she did see one over and over again.
There was only one theater, and it perpetually and perennially showed Dr. Zhivago. It was weird because sometimes the power in the theater would go off and it was swelteringly hot, and you would see just the image of snow and icicles on Omar Sharif's beard.
Meera Nair, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org. Thanks.